Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, Dr. Martin Luther King Day, the 19th of January. We have much to discuss this hour of the program. We are going to be speaking with two guests who are on the ground in Haiti, one a spokesperson for the UN. That building, of course, collapsed, as you know, and many people who work for the UN were killed in Haiti, many others injured. There are an estimated 3 million to 3.5 million people in need of aid. The aid is pouring in. We will also speak to an NPR producer. They have a team on the ground. So our 9:30 segment this morning will be looking at Haiti from people who are indeed looking at Haiti from that country. First half hour, it's all things political. And we are going to be speaking primarily, although there are other subjects, about tomorrow's special election in Massachusetts, where the perception today is the race could be closer than many people think it might be. Martha Coakley, the Democrat who's running for Senator Edward Kennedy's seat in Massachusetts, had seemed so certain of winning the special election that she barely campaigned last month. But the dynamic, of course, has changed. The president was in Massachusetts on Sunday, yesterday, campaigning for her. How close is this and why is it close? This, of course, receiving a lot of national attention because it could switch the makeup of the Senate and put health care reform perhaps in peril. Our guest the first half hour is Dennis Hale. He is associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Boston College. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Dennis Hale, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
So did the president turn the tide yesterday in Massachusetts or not?
Well, we'll see. He certainly gave it his best shot. He talked about how he needs Martha Coakley by his side to finish the work that he's begun. Those voters who are enthusiastic about that work will be inclined to go vote for Martha Coakley.
Mm-hmm. It is ironic, isn't it, that this is Teddy Kennedy's seat and that health care could be affected pretty dramatically by the outcome of tomorrow's race.
Yes, it is, and it's almost like a Greek drama.
Mm.
But there's a certain irony, but I think there's also a certain appropriateness. We talk about healthcare reform as if there is only one way to reform healthcare, and that was certainly, I think, Senator Kennedy's view, that the kind of legislation that the House and the Senate and the President have been crafting over the past year is the way to go, but there is certainly a lot of doubt about that among members of the public. And the fact is, I think, that neither Senator Kennedy nor the current leadership of the Congress has made the case to the public for why this particular kind of health care reform is both necessary and appropriate. So there's a certain irony when the president said yesterday something like, we need to send Martha Coakley to the Senate so we can finish what we started. The problem is that the public has some doubts about what the president has started, and they may very well not want him to finish what he started.
Hmm. Tell me about her opponent.
Her opponent is a member of the state Senate in Massachusetts, one of only five Republicans in the state Senate.
Oh, my.
Five out of 40.
Woo.
He's a guy who's been around Massachusetts politics for a while. He's still is in the military. He was in the JAG Corps, so he's an accomplished guy, and he's got a certain kind of appeal at the moment, particularly to independent voters in the state, of whom there are very many. This Massachusetts is often described as a Democratic state, and in some way, that's of course true. But it might be described also as an overwhelmingly independent state. I mean, over half the voters now, 51%, are unenrolled, or as we call them in other places, independents. And so the Democratic Party is not the majority party. In fact, there is no majority party unless we consider unenrolled voters to be a party. So he's got an audience that is prepared to listen to a message about I'm not a Democrat. We need some balance in the state. Why shouldn't there be at least one Republican in the Massachusetts congressional delegation, and so on? So he's getting a response.
And has he built his platform on opposition to health care reform?
He has said explicitly that he will be the 41st vote to stop the debate and end this particular version of health care reform. So he's been quite open about that, and it's on the basis of that, he's closed the gap, what was a 31-point gap at the beginning of the campaign, to what would have to be described as a race that's too close to call.
Isn't that a feat?
It's a feat, but if you look at the public opinion polls, out in state and outside the state, the health care reform is not popular. It's not even popular in Massachusetts, although it's a little bit more popular here than nationally. So I think when this is all over and we write the history of the first couple of years of the Obama administration, it might turn out to be that the case that the Democrats suffered from a certain kind of hubris that was generated by their supermajority. It might have been better if they had not tried something quite so ambitious.
And why is it that there is opposition in Massachusetts, of all places, to the current health care reform? We don't know exactly what it is yet.
Well, that's part of the problem. I mean, it's a moving target, and it keeps evolving like some kind of virus. But it's there are certain elements of this plan, as it's been described and even defended, that apparently worry people. One is the extraordinary addition to the deficit that it will create, something like $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years. That will lead, many people think, in the state and outside the state, to significant cuts in Medicare down the road. There is a fear, I think, that people will lose the kind of health insurance they've got. I mean, it always helps in talking about this to remember that most Americans do have health insurance, and they do say that they are satisfied with it, although they worry about things like portability. So it's not as if everybody in the state loves the current health insurance system, but there appears to be some doubt about whether the thing that's being proposed, or the things that are being proposed by the House and the Senate, are the kind of improvement that they can live with or be happy with.
You were quoted in the New York Times as saying, if I had to bet a week's salary, I'd still bet it on Coakley, but this is going to be like in the military where the bullet misses you, but it still scares you to death.
Right. I would have to say that I would not bet my week's salary on Martha Coakley at this point.
You would not?
I would not, no. It's really, the last poll I saw was 2 days ago, and it was, he was ahead by about 3 points. I find that hard to believe, but nevertheless, there it is. This was the Rasmussen poll, and they have generally been pretty accurate. They were the best, for example, at predicting Obama's victory over Clinton in the primaries, and they called the election within one-tenth of a point. So they're pretty good at this kind of thing, and opinion polls are difficult except when people are asked a very simple question: do you intend to do A or B? And when they can say, when they can answer that kind of a question, there's some level of confidence. There will be a question about turnout, and that's of course why the president came to Boston. This is an off-year election, obviously a very special circumstance. Nothing else is going on politically, and so normally that would mean a very low turnout. I mean, that's sort of the classic political science lesson. If there's only one election, not very many people will show up for it. This election may very well be different, but it may be different for different parts of the population. The Bostonians who like President Obama a lot may simply not see that they have a dog in this particular hunt, and they may stay home. Whereas the independents who have felt sort of alienated from Massachusetts politics for such a long time, they are obviously energized, and they will turn out. And the weather tomorrow is supposed to be decent, so nature will not intervene, I don't think.
Right. What about the cause of the lifetime, Teddy Kennedy's cause of the lifetime, his long service in the Senate, mm-hmm. and the fact that he just recently died, is there not a vote for that?
There is a vote for that, but the Democrats apparently overestimated its size. I think they've overestimated the affection with which Massachusetts voters held Senator Kennedy. I mean, I do not intend to speak ill of the dead, but Senator Kennedy was not as popular as his press releases would have you think. For a long time, remember, he was notable for his misbehavior, and right. this was something that everybody knew about in Massachusetts as well as everywhere. So the idea that this is his seat, or that we ought to pass a bill that he would have supported, whatever that bill might be, that's not going to be enough to win the election.
We welcome your phone calls, audience. Whenever you'd like to join in, we're happy to take your phone calls. It's All Things Political this hour. The first half hour, we're looking primarily at that very important Senate race tomorrow in Massachusetts. And our guest is Professor Dennis Hale, Associate Professor, Department of Political Science at Boston College. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. The second half hour, we will talk about Haiti. We'll have two guests with us who are on the ground in Haiti. One is a deputy spokesperson for the United Nations Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Aid. A lot of money coming in. How is it being distributed? How much is needed on this Dr. Martin Luther King Day? It is a question sometimes of what can you give, right? And also we'll be speaking with Amy Walters, who's a producer for National Public Radio. She has been in Haiti since last Thursday. 800-486-8655. Professor Hale, what's happened in the last year to make this seat not very safe for the Democrats? And can we say there is a significant anti-Obama sentiment in this country?
I think there's a couple of things, one on the national level, one on the state level. On the national level, the leadership of the Congress and the administration have, for whatever reason, pushed some policies very insistently that are clearly not popular with the public. The health care bill is one of them. Closing Gitmo is another. Bringing the terrorists to New York to try in a civilian court, that's another one. The stimulus plan was wildly unpopular in many places, and I think that this has to be separated from views about Obama himself. I mean, after all, he did get elected with 54% of the vote. That's a pretty good margin of victory by recent standards, you know, compared to 2004 and 2000. But by historic standards, it's not that great a margin, and it might have been a good idea if Democrats had read the lesson of that election and said, okay, we got a majority, we got the White House, you know, but let's not push it too far because, you know, this is, you know, we don't run everything. I think they got a little bit carried away with themselves. So I think this is is opposition to certain policies more than it is dislike of the president. Ironically, he's falling into a category that President Bush fell into. You remember, people liked Bush, but they didn't like his performance in office. Mm-hmm. And I think this is what's beginning to happen with President Obama. People like him, but they just don't like, they rate him now kind of low. He's got less than a majority now willing to say that he's doing a good job.
Let's go to phone calls. Jim from Milwaukee, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to recommend a contemporary play set in contemporary time at the Milwaukee Rep, and I think it's such an important play that I think people should even drive in from outstate to see it. It's called Yankee Tavern. You can check it out on the MilwaukeeRep.com, and if you can't see it, you can go to the net under A&E911truth.org, which is put on by the American Association of American Architects and Engineers, and it pokes fun at conspiracy theories, but it also, and so it's very entertaining, but at the same time, it comes up with some stuff that's very, very serious and very well presented and reasoned that will will certainly shake the foundation of your thoughts if you look at it.
Yes?
Okay.
Okay.
That's it. All right. Thanks, Jim, very much for your call. Let's go next to Chris from Antioch, Illinois. Hi, Chris.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Fine. How are you?
Very good. Thank you. I was just driving to work, and just a little bit of ignorance. I heard on the national news today that one thing that might affect the voters in Massachusetts is I'm a little ignorant to their current health care in Massachusetts, but I heard the comment that might affect how they vote, because that might not be a concern, national health care, based on their own health care.
No. In fact, it's quite the opposite. We have, ironically, a health care reform that was enacted under the previous administration, gubernatorial administration, and it was ultimately the result of things that Governor Romney did when he was here. It's not quite like the Senate and House bills, but it's in the ballpark. That is to say, it does require people to have insurance. There is a comprehensive program for people who can't afford health insurance. It was designed to create a private health insurance market by pushing people to buy insurance, and it was really pushed by the hospitals, who felt that they were going out of business because of people using emergency rooms as their health insurance plan. So it has not been wildly successful. It's not terrible, but it's much more expensive than it was predicted to be. So I think people in Massachusetts who look at this think, well, it's not really working here. It's not likely to work on the national scale either, and maybe we need to think differently about how to deal with the healthcare problem.
Thanks for the call. We're taking more in a moment. All Things Political, this Dr. Martin Luther King Day. Our guest the first half hour, Professor Dennis Hale. He is Associate Professor, Department of Political Science at Boston College. Second half hour, we'll talk about Haiti. Our guests are on the ground in Haiti. We'll speak with Deputy Spokesperson for the United Nations Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, and we'll speak with a producer for National Public Radio. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Dennis Hale, our guest this half hour. Mark from Appleton, hello.
Hi, is this Mark from Appleton?
Yes, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to make a comment about the professor was talking about the hubris of the Democrats, and as a Democrat, I find I'm very frustrated because, you know, there is a majority, a large majority in the Senate. There is a majority in the House. Obama was elected with 55% of the vote, which is far more than in the Bush elections, but also Clinton never had over 50%, neither 92 nor 96, I believe. So there is, you know, I'm frustrated by the fact that the hubris of the Republicans, who feel that with a very small minority and with a minority based on small states, have the right to keep blocking everything that Obama wants to do. And I think that's certainly frustrating. And I think part of the problem, too, is when people are asked about the health care bill or if they're satisfied with it, they may feel, as I do, that it probably doesn't go far enough, although I do think it's a great thing if we can finally get rid of practices such as denying people coverage for pre-existing conditions and things like that.
Professor Hale.
Yes, hi. Well, I'm in response, I can only say that the rules of American politics are what they are, and they've been that way for a long time. To get major changes done in this country, you need the support of people outside your own faction. Now, the ability of minorities to block legislation isn't permanent. It doesn't go on forever. But when that opposition in the Congress is matched by opposition in the public, then it seems to me that the leaders of the party in power need to take a look at that and adjust their plans accordingly. The hubris that I'm talking about is what led the Democrats, I think, to make the mistake of not being entirely open about what it is they were proposing. And then part of the difficulty there is the unpopularity of what might be described as a single-payer health care plan. This is something that progressives have wanted for a long time, and, you know, there are reasons to think that you could defend such a policy, but you would have to do so openly, and the Democrats, I think, were a little bit reluctant to talk about that.
And yet, he brings up the point that we've got this Democratic majority in the House and the Senate. President Obama was elected. What did that mean? What were we voting for?
You vote for a president, and you get a president, and that's it. This is not a parliamentary system where a president comes into power with a party program. I mean, compare this, for example, to 1948, I think it was, when the Labor Party was elected on a platform that promised to socialize the medical care system. And that was an open promise. Everybody understood that's what it would mean if the Labor Party was elected to Parliament, and that's what happened. We don't have a parliamentary system. The president is elected to be the chief executive. And he wasn't, in fact, elected on the promise that he would enact a single-payer health care system. So, in other words, we have a different kind of system, and the Democrats have been a little bit clumsy in the way they have proposed their agenda. It's not popular, and they haven't done a very good job of defending it, I think.
Thanks, Mark, for your call. We have time for maybe one more phone call. Quincy is next. Hi, Quincy. Where are you from?
Mindoro.
Mindoro.
Kind of middle of nowhere, but we kind of like it.
Okay. Go right ahead, Quincy.
Well, thanks for taking my call. It's just this matter of partisanship that's been going on. I think a lot of the public is really angry because you can't get anything done for no one wanting to work together. And it seems that if we're going to actually get anything that's agreeable for the country as a whole, it's going to take both parties. And it seems as soon as one party gets in, no one wants to work with the other party, or they try to ramrod something through without actually trying to get more information. I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Quincy.
Well, I would say that's not entirely true. During the early years of the Bush administration, Democrats and Republicans worked together on things like the No Child Left Behind Act, educational reform. It was the Congress that passed, the so-called Bush tax cuts. There was some movement in the direction of reforming Social Security. I mean, the model of the Social Security Commission, which was a bipartisan commission, seems to work pretty well. And I'm a little surprised that the Democrats didn't choose such a mechanism for healthcare reform. I mean, this bill was in a way sprung on the country very quickly. I think they're just the Democrats just didn't do enough work to prepare the ground for such a sweeping change in a system that people are generally happy with. I mean, that it really does help to remember that. If you want to solve a public problem, you have to first of all figure out whether most people in the country think it's actually a problem, or how they think it's a problem. What is it about the current health system that people are worried about or object to, and then kind of address that. But the Democrats, I think, as I said earlier, somewhat got carried away with their margin of victory, and got a little bit too ambitious, and they flew a little too close to the sun.
But I can remember, Professor Hale, when it was much more a bipartisan issue. I can remember tons of interviews with business people who were highly concerned about how their expenses were going up, everybody
right.
concerned about the number of uninsured in this country. There are a lot of things that are wrong with the system that everybody agrees on.
Absolutely, and I think if the Democrats had said to the Republicans, look, you guys got some ideas, we got some ideas, let's work together on this, and let's not have any presumptions about where we're going. We're not going to insist on a single-payer system because we know that you don't like that, and
right.
much of the public doesn't like that. But that's not how it started. I mean, there are a number of things that healthcare observers, experts of various sorts, have identified as problematic. The first thing, of course, is the spiraling costs. Another thing is the portability of health insurance. It's linked to jobs. This is one of the reasons why we have so many people who are uninsured. They don't have jobs that provide health insurance, and there is no efficient health insurance market And that's another thing that the Democrats might have fixed but didn't talk about, and that is the anti-competitive way in which states regulate health insurance. There's really no efficient market out there, and partly as a result of that, many people who could afford health insurance get frozen out because they can't buy, for example, I mean, a 25-year-old can't buy catastrophic health insurance. The sort of thing that a 25-year-old person just entering the market, the job market, would probably like to have, in many states, most states, in fact, that's simply not available because of state regulation. So all of these things might have been talked about, but they weren't, unfortunately. And that's, I think that this might be an opportunity to start all over again, and begin the new session of Congress with a different understanding of how to go about health care reform.
Hmm. What happens tomorrow if Brown wins?
Well, if Brown wins, then there's about a three-week window when the votes have to be certified, the absentee ballots have to be checked, and so on. Then they have to, all that has to be, all the paperwork has to be done down in Washington. And my understanding is that that should not take more than 3 weeks. It could take less, of course. And then he would be sworn in, and that would be, as he says, he would be the 41st vote. And that means that the Democrats would have to revisit their understanding of what health care reform will mean going into the new session.
Mm-hmm. All right, one more phone call, and then we'll go to Haiti. Mike, we hope. Mike from Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, thanks for squeezing me in. The comment that I'd like to make is, what a shame that Obama lost a brilliant opportunity to do so many things. And, you know, he turned it over to Pelosi and Reid. And a critical mistake there. Second critical mistake, of course, was they didn't read it right. The problem today is jobs. They should have, I mean, in January, they were losing 700,000 jobs a month. That's the problem that they should have attacked immediately and leave health care for the second, you know, the second year. Just an unbelievable misreading of reality.
Thank you. Yes, I agree. I think that's true. And in Massachusetts, jobs, that's part of the fear about health care reform, that it will impose the kind of mandates and taxes on employers that you don't want when the unemployment rate in the state here recently, or at the moment, is 8.8%. It's actually been coming down a little bit, but still there's a lot of people out of work who would ordinarily not be unemployed.
And what should the president be doing about that issue?
I think the you mean unemployment?
Yes.
That's a good question. I think that it would. It's partly a question of what he should not be doing, and I think your caller was right. The Congress should not at the moment be talking about adding another $1.5 trillion to the national debt, talking about employer mandate taxes, taxes on Cadillac healthcare plans. I mean, all of this stuff is just the wrong message to send in a recession, especially when nothing in this bill offers any credible possibility of reducing health care costs. There is not a case on record of something becoming cheaper when it's turned over to the federal bureaucracy. I mean, everybody knows this. This is not rocket science. So the sort of anti-job growth, economic growth message coming out of the White House and the Congress, messages, plural, I think are very damaging, and I would hope that in the next session of Congress, everybody has read the tea leaves correctly and will shift gears. And that doesn't necessarily mean that health care reform of some kind is hopeless, but I think health care reform of the kind that Senator Kennedy believed in may be doomed.
Mm. Thank you so much. It'll be fascinating to see what happens in Massachusetts tomorrow, and we thank you so much for your time, Professor Hale.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Professor Dennis Hale, Associate Professor, Department of Political Science at Boston College. We're going to go to Haiti now. We've had, as you can imagine, it's difficult to get through to the country, and the phone line is not great, but we're very happy that our first guest from the United Nations is with us. Nicholas Reeder is a deputy spokesperson for the United Nations Office of the coordination of humanitarian affairs, and what a huge job that is. Joining us from Haiti, I assume from Port-au-Prince, Nicholas, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Oh, we hear you quite well now. How long have you been there? Were you there for the earthquake, Nicholas?
I got into Port-au-Prince on Friday last week.
Uh-huh. And tell us about the efforts today. We keep hearing that there's much more humanitarian aid finally making its way to the people. Have you seen a significant increase in the aid?
Well, that's right. The first few days of the operation were very much focused on the search and rescue work. Most lives can be saved initially from the in the hours and days after the disaster. The search and rescue operation that was eventually mounted was the largest that's ever been deployed anywhere in the world. There are more than 1,700 search and rescue experts in the city, and they've also saved more lives than they've ever saved before. At the end of the day yesterday, they pulled 71 people alive out of the wreckage. So that's excellent. But you're absolutely right that, yes, there is much more evidence of humanitarian aid getting into the country now. There's much more relief getting out onto the streets. We still do need to see a lot more shelter, a lot more sanitation, water, food, and medical care are going to be our priorities. But there is a lot more getting in now, yeah.
Yes. We have heard on news reports that there has been an uptick in violence. Is that noticeable to you?
From the relief perspective, that hasn't. I mean, we've seen the reports. Obviously, we're very conscious of the security for our staff who are working out in the streets. But it hasn't yet had an impact on our operations. We're receiving very good security and policing support from the United Nations mission here in Port-au-Prince, MINUSTA. They accompany all of the relief teams that we send out and also all the search and rescue teams. So far, thankfully, we haven't had any more incidents with our staff. We haven't had any more loss of life.
So many people have said that this is the worst devastation that they have ever seen, that it is just horrendous, Nicholas. Would you agree with that?
This is doubtlessly one of the worst disasters that we've seen for many years. I took the Secretary General's visit yesterday. As part of that, we were on a helicopter overflight to some of the affected areas. There are parts of the city where the devastation is quite light. Less than perhaps 10% of the buildings have collapsed. There are other parts, particularly closer to the epicenter, where the estimates are much higher, around 80 to 90% of all the buildings in some areas have collapsed. There are still many, many thousands of people homeless. We estimate around 200,000 families in the city are without shelter at the moment. That's about 1 million people. Of the total affected population, we believe to be around 3 million. That means pretty much one in every three Haitians has been affected by this disaster.
Mm. And you'll have to be there for the long term, won't you? When you look at pictures of this, it looks like the city was just devastated. You have to rebuild a country, essentially.
Well, that's what makes this such a complex crisis for the national authorities and for ourselves, the United Nations and the humanitarian community. It was a very severe earthquake. At the same time, the national authorities and the United Nations in the country were both heavily affected, as well as, of course, the population themselves. So while we're trying to assist the population, we're also having to grapple with many of the same issues that they are.
Mm.
You know, the humanitarian operations are really running out of rebuilding themselves. We still don't have offices. We don't have places to sleep properly at the moment. Things are improving every day, but we have to get our own operations back online as much as the country. But certainly this is going to be a very long-run operation. It's building up quickly, and we're going to keep seeing it building up for months to come now, absolutely.
The figures that we hear, 3 million to 3.5 million people in need of aid. Can you tell me what kind of aid is needed? And I know that people have been giving all over the world. How you recommend they would give and what people need right now? I guess it's everything, isn't it?
It is. People have lost everything, absolutely everything. The kinds of assistance they need are just the very basic things, the shelter. They need water and food and primary medical care. But the best way that people can help us do that is with money, not by sending the items themselves. We've launched an appeal for $563 million, and within that appeal, it includes projects run by non-governmental organizations, by the United Nations, by bilateral donors. So if people want to help, it would be best if they give money to an organization which is within the appeal, they find an organization that they trust. And then that means that their money will be going to a project which is part of a coordinated humanitarian program, because we want to minimize inefficiencies here. We want to maximize the effectiveness of the relief on the ground. So we're trying to avoid overlap. We're trying to make sure that things are linked up. For example, when something arrives at the airport, we also need to have people to transport it. We need to have people to put it on the ground. We need to have people to distribute it. If it's a medical center, you need people to run it. So we've launched this appeal, which has joined up projects, and we would very much urge people, and I know there are many, many people who have already generously given and who are very concerned about the situation here, which is great, and we'd urge them to keep supporting the appeal process.
Yes.
It's very much needed.
And do you have a sense that somebody's in charge of all this distribution and in keeping things calm? Is there a government functioning? Who's in charge?
There is a national authorities. The United Nations here, we liaise with them on a daily basis, and they are feeding into our work very closely by advising us, for example, on where the highest concentrations of displaced people can be found around the city and the outlying areas. They advise us, for example, on where they think the best places for us to put distribution sites would be. These kinds of things. And then we feed information back to them as to what kind of assistance we can provide when things are coming into the country. So there's a strong coordination, and then of course there's the large US military presence here, which we're also coordinating with. So the point is that if we're going to really meet the needs here, or get close to meeting the needs, we are all going to have to work in partnership. We're going to have to work very closely together. There's a lot of different actors here, the national authorities, the UN, and everybody else. And we do need to be working very closely, and that so far does seem to be happening.
Mm. And you have to be mourning yourself because you lost people from the UN center in Port-au-Prince, right?
That's right. That's right. As I said, the UN operations physically are reconstructing themselves, but also many of the staff here are grappling with the loss of very close friends and colleagues as well. And not just the international staff, but of course a lot of the national staff here have been more affected. They had larger families in the country. Quite often in these operations, the national staff themselves, who are really the backbone that keep everything running. It's Monday morning here. The UN compound is really bustling with people. People have got a good spirit, and they are coming back to work, even though they're affected. I think there's a real sense of solidarity that people do want to come together and really focus on doing as much as we can for the people who've survived. And having seen the scale of this disaster, it really is a miracle that people did survive, and we really want to do what we can for them.
Yes, there are many miracles, but much horror too. Nicholas, thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
Nicholas Reeder, Deputy Spokesperson for the United Nations Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, and as you know, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon made an emotional visit to the Haiti peacekeeping mission's headquarters on Sunday and delivered a message of hope to the country's earthquake victims, acknowledging that many of the survivors are growing desperate. The UN World Food Program starting to feed 1 million people in 2 weeks and 2 million people in 1 month. And there, as we said earlier, are an estimated 3 million to 3.5 million people in need of aid. We are going to continue reports from Haiti. We'll be speaking in just one moment with Amy Walters, who is a producer for National Public Radio, and they have several teams on the ground in Haiti. And we'll be welcoming your phone calls as well, so please join us. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or send an email if you'd like, talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Amy Walters is joining us now, producer for National Public Radio, and we do welcome phone calls for her. She is in Haiti. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Hello, Amy. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, thank you.
Hi. Where are you?
I'm in a neighborhood called Pétainville. It is it's basically up a little bit in the mountains. It's a nicer neighborhood of Port-au-Prince. It's a little less affected than some of the downtown areas have been, but we've definitely seen our share of damage here, and I've, of course, been all over town and seen what's gone on there. It's quite devastating.
I've heard over the weekend that people have not been able to make their way up to where you are right now, and there is a need outside the downtown Port-au-Prince area. Is that right?
I think that's very true. We have been able to make our way back and forth from this, you know, this is our base camp. I think that there are a few main roads that go up and down the hills to here, but as far as aid, you know, the vehicles we're in are much smaller than some of the backhoes and the heavy machinery that they probably need for the larger operations. There are many, many other villages and neighborhoods up in the surrounding hills, many less fortunate and harder hit than we are. I haven't even been to many of those, but I've heard reports from people that I've talked to in the city center that those neighborhoods are very hard hit and that aid hasn't reached them at all.
Mm-hmm. But it's expected to be there perhaps in the next few days? Is that what you hear?
I'm sorry?
Do you expect there will be aid moving into those areas, or is the need so overwhelming in the central part of Haiti that that work has to be done first?
You know, it's hard to know how people are going to approach this. The need, it's such a large area. I think you could probably attack it from any variety of positions and do good work. I think that a lot of people have gathered in the center because they have a sense that that's where the aid is going. But it's really hard to get information on where these drops are happening. Yesterday, I was at the soccer stadium where a large number of people were camped out. Intense. The day prior, they had had a visit from the UN and the American military with aid. They thought that there was going to be more aid the following day, and it wasn't there. There wasn't any food, at least by the time I left at 2 p.m. in the afternoon yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it
remarkable,
Amy, that they have been able to rescue people, 5 days after the earthquake? People are still alive.
It is remarkable. I actually had a report from one of my colleagues, Jackie Northam, who was out with an Icelandic search and rescue team. They were doing some rescue operations, but what she had heard was that there was a Russian group that had actually rescued more than 60 people, than 60 people alive from an air pocket, obviously a large one, in a shopping mall. It's really hard to know if to verify this information because it is so sporadic. The communication systems are very hard to use here and spotty. But yeah, people are still coming out, and I'm not sure how that happens.
Yeah. Are people still sleeping outside? Where are people sleeping and eating, and how are they just surviving from day to day?
Definitely, people are still sleeping outside. Yeah, you know, some streets are impassable from rubble. Some people's streets are quasi impassable because people have set up tents there. They've basically turned their entire lives outside. Seen people, you know, sitting on rocking chairs, eating bowls of cereal, taking showers, you know, things that everybody does inside. It's all been transferred outside. As far as food goes, I mean, everybody's doing what they can. There's, like I said, the aid has been very erratic. It's hard to know where it's coming. You know, the aid trucks that we have seen, we've seen water trucks, and I've seen some food distribution. People, you know, there's huge lines, some more organized than others. And people are saying, you know, they're trying to listen. If the food truck's not coming to their neighborhood, they're trying to go to the next neighborhood. And sometimes, you know, they'll have friends, they'll have neighbors in that other neighborhood who will have been able to obtain some water, who will have been able to obtain some food, and they'll cook food and they'll offer it to each other. There's a lot. Fortunately, one thing that Haiti does have going for it is a very, very tight, you know, network of families and friends that are really willing to help each other out. So if someone obtains, you know, food or water, they're more than likely to share it with other people.
Do they know, do you think, most people know that, first of all, they have signs that help is there, but do they know that a massive amount of aid is on the way?
You know, people are hopeful. They hope, that, you know, almost everybody I talk to says, you know, we're waiting for the Americans to come. We want the Americans to come. I think that they don't really have a lot of choice aside from hoping. But it's been erratic. It hasn't been, you know, they haven't seen as much water. They haven't seen as much food as they would like. I was in a neighborhood yesterday where they got their first tank of water and hadn't seen any food at all yet. So, I mean, it's a really, really big area. There's a lot of people and a lot of need. And I think it's just now in these past couple of days getting in there, and there's a lot more places that it needs to go.
The pictures are just awful. There is an overwhelming amount of need. It must knock you out when you see this.
Yeah. No, there's some really unbearable sights. Mm. You know, the worst thing is just seeing these buildings, and you see all these collapsed buildings, and, you know, many of them still have people inside, and, you know, some of them were probably living for a while, and it's not clear what's happened now. And
oops, are you there? Oh, I think we may have lost connection with her. We'll try again. It was very clear for a while. We'll try to link again to Amy Walters, who is joining us on the ground from Haiti, where she is an NPR producer. And as you know, NPR has several teams in Haiti right now following all that's going on. We're welcoming your phone calls, too, if you'd like to join the conversation on this day that we celebrate Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday. The answer to the question, what can you give? What have you given? What have you been able to take in and give out as a result of this horrendous tragedy? It has been, I've watched a lot of coverage of this, maybe too much, but the magnitude of the tragedy is just incredible, isn't it? And when you think about all that has to be done to essentially rebuild a country, and who has the vision of how it should be rebuilt and who will do all of that. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. Our connection cut off. We do hope, but as you know, the communication is sometimes sporadic there, and we'll try to reconnect with Amy for the last couple minutes. I believe she's calling in right now. So we'll get more information about how they're rebuilding the country, restructuring the country, how the food is getting in, et cetera. And I believe she's back with us again. There we go. Hi, Amy.
I'm sorry.
It's all right.
Speaks to our communication problems here, I think.
Yeah, I understand. Although they certainly are a lot better than they were last week. We were wondering as well, how do people know, because you got a breakdown in communication here and in phones, et cetera, if there is food available in a certain place, is it all just word of mouth? So people go to a place and maybe it may not be good information and there is no food there?
That definitely happens, partially because the information is not good, partially because people change. First of all, to answer your first question about how people know, there is radio. There's several radio stations, including Radio Carib. A lot of the people I talk to have been getting information that way. But I'll tell you, yesterday afternoon, and I don't know why this was, if it was to try to keep people calm or just because that's what the Sunday afternoon program is, there was a lot of classical music on the radio, which seemed unusual to me in a situation like this. But as far as people showing up at the wrong place, that definitely happens. A, because they show up at the wrong place. B, because the situation changes. Yesterday, like I said, I was at the stadium. A Korean church group pulled up in a van with food to give out, but they were so rushed by the crowd that they actually had to pull away and leave. They were concerned for their own security, and the food never got to that group. Things just change all the time. Like I said, the 82nd Airborne was supposed to show up at the stadium yesterday, and I think that they ran out of supplies a little earlier than they expected and weren't able to make it there yesterday and are saying they'll be able to get there today.
There were reports that some supplies had been backed up at the airport. Is the pipeline from the airport to Port-au-Prince open now?
It's open. It's definitely open. It's a little clogged. It's congested. There's been a hard time, you know, getting from one place to another. And security is a major concern. I think the U.S. has taken it very seriously. I know that there's been teams from the U.S. that have been held up at the airport for I think at least 5 hours waiting for a security unit to go out with them, and that's been an issue for the American military too. But there's, you know, there's security, there's just plain traffic problems that have been holding things up.
Yeah, and is it hard to cover all this, just your physical well-being? Are you able to eat and have a place to sleep?
We actually are very lucky. One of my colleagues, Carrie Kahn, got here the first night. She managed to find a little piece of lawn at the front of this hotel that we ended up getting a couple rooms in now. Things have been really good for us here. They managed to have purified water and food. But even here, things are sporadic. There's no hot water. Yesterday, the water period shut off for the half an hour or so. Mm-hmm. And it's not clear, you know, what the future is. We're getting the supplies now.
And it is not clear what the future is. Thank you, Amy, so much for being with us. We need to go to the news and get further updates on Haiti. Thanks to Amy Walters for joining us and to Rhonda Fanning for putting together a heck of an hour. We'll be getting more live reports from Haiti during the course of the week. This is the Ideas Network.